high school. To this day, the very words provoke in me the kind of anxious repulsion occasioned by terms like colonic irrigation, root canal, or George W. Bush. I loathed being in high school, loathed it so utterly and viscerally that I was hardly aware of the cause of my discontent. I seethed with a restless unhappiness wildly in excess of the usual teenage surliness and sense of entitlement. I proved curiously intractable in my ignorance, unwilling to learn much, like the hero of Sam Cooke's Wonderful World, who didn't know much about history, biology, or the French he took. I was regarded as bright, but like Mr. Cooke's hero, I was not an A student, which allowed my teachers, enthusiastically, to describe me as an underachiever. But advanced English, we called it double X as if a coded form of obscenity, with Miss Wyeth in my senior year, was a different kettle of literary fish. Relentlessly high-minded in the way bright and frustrated high school teachers can be, Miss Wyeth had composed a year-long crash course in Western literature and philosophy. She was a Mooney fan of my father's, who was president of the local arts council, and had decided that I should be the star of her show. She would pick me from the back of the class, where I sat, slouched over my desk doing the New York Times crossword puzzle, to ask the most trenchant questions. "And what do you think, Rick, of the quality of this translation of Aristotle by Dudley Fitts?" "Well," I said, "it seems to me admirably to exemplify the old phrase," Miss Wyeth gave me an anticipatory glare, "if the Dudley fits, wear it." "Out," she said, pointing to the door. I knew the way to the principal's office by then. Word of mouth had led me there frequently enough. He looked up wearily as I entered his office. "What is it this time?" "Well, sir," I said, as contritely as possible, "I insulted Dudley Fitts in Miss Wyeth's class." The principal was no classicist. "What did you say to him?" "I was teasing him about his name, sir." "Well," he said firmly, "I want you to go back to class immediately and apologize to Dudley. You know, the school honor code requires courtesy between students." "I'd be extremely happy to do that, sir." Retelling the story over dinner, I thought my dad would rather admire my wit, though he was getting tired of coming to school to apologize for my behavior, which I was generally unwilling to do on my own behalf. "She had it coming," I would say, steadfastly, though I felt a little guilty. Miss Wyeth wasn't a moron or a phony like many of the other teachers. This unpleasant, dismissive language I had learned from my contemporary, a 17-year-old named Holden Caulfield, who was one of my closest confidants. You will remember him as the hero and narrator of J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, which was much my favorite book at the time. Holden is a dropout from a series of posh prep schools, but unlike me, was no smart aleck. Unfailingly polite and inclined in public to take the blame for his many academic shortcomings, he too only liked English, Holden is internally scathingly dismissive of almost everyone who has taught him. He is a veritable walking crap detector, unfailingly sensitive to every cliche, insincerity, and bit of educational jargon. Holden and I, we were in opposition, unreceptive to secondhand wisdom, unwilling to take counsel from self-appointed betters. But there were two things I failed to learn from him. First was how to keep my mouth shut, but second, and significantly, was how to fail. Holden will not do what he doesn't believe in, study what doesn't interest him, take advice where it doesn't resonate with what he needs. And there is some integrity in this. The more good-willed educators praise the value of what he is being offered, the more he rejects it. Failure is a confirmation of his integrity. But Holden Caulfield was in a situation radically different from my own. We may both have been surly high school kids, but Holden had adequate reason for his disaffection, what T.S. Eliot called an objective correlative. Holden is profoundly and admittedly depressed, his only attachments being to his younger sister Phoebe and to the memory of Allie, his adored kid brother, who died when Holden was 13. The day that Allie died, Holden broke his hand smashing windows in the garage. 3 years later, his hand still hurts, and he is still angry, but that anger has twisted and turned inwards. What did I experience that I should have found his situation so sympathetic? If I had a sense of loss, it was only obscurely a product of a child-centered environment. I had fallen from an egocentric state of innocence into a world that expected me to center on it. Whereas Holden's sense of loss, so unlike my own, is sympathetic, conscious, and overwhelming. He is filled with numb rage and unshed tears. No one seems to have helped him properly. I like to think that he needed to have read Allen Ginsberg. Now, Holden couldn't have read Howl, which was published 5 years after Catcher in the Rye, but I was lucky enough in 1960 to read both books and in the right order, because Howl begins where Catcher ends, in a mental hospital, where a tormented and intensely bright inmate is trying and failing to make peace in and with the world. Though it is often referred to simply as Howl, Ginsberg's book is fully entitled Howl for Carl Solomon, a lament for a mad friend. It begins like this. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix. Who was this stylistic hooligan? I'd never read anything like that before. Words stomping about the page without discernible rhythms, much less rhymes. Lawless and free. Whatever this was, it certainly wasn't poetry. It was better than poetry. Poetry was as easy and as memorable as that contemporary hit by the Shirelles, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? If Ginsberg's lines call Holden Caulfield to mind, leaving school, drunk in a seedy New York hotel room, angry and desperate, dreaming of an escape to the lonely outreaches of the West, they also transcend him entirely. You could relate to Holden Caulfield, internalize him as a friend. But Allen Ginsberg? No, he was neither a friend nor someone inwardly to consult, and his voice wasn't so easily interjected. If Holden was a comfortable companion, Ginsberg made me both excited and anxious. And what he provoked in me was a fierce desire for escape. He made me feel both trapped and pathetic. Yet the net effect of this was curiously exhilarating. The major antecedents of Howl, which seems a quintessentially modern poem, still lie in the 19th century, in James Fenimore Cooper and Huckleberry Finn, and particularly in Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, which Ginsberg had read while at high school in New Jersey. Walt's dictum, "I am huge, I contain multitudes," became the young Ginsberg's mantra, and the panoptically loving Howl embraces the outlawed and the outcast, the rejected, the poor, the black, the downtrodden, more than accepts but celebrates that which tests boundaries, attacks prejudice, transgresses. In those wonderfully apposite words of Whitman's, re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any books, and dismiss whatever insults your soul. I wasn't quite sure, contemplating this lofty sentiment at the age of 17, quite what insulting one's soul might consist of. I had certainly heard of souls, but I was unsure whether I had, or indeed whether I wanted one. They sounded pesky things, these souls, a bit like puppies, endlessly importuning, hungry for sustenance, altogether too demanding. But soul or no soul, the arrival of Allen signaled the end of my identification with Holden. He and I had not yet got past a negative version of dismissing. We were ruthlessly without charity. Ginsberg pointed the way to something larger, more generous, and more dangerous. Years later, I was lucky enough to hear him singing with his partner Peter Orlovsky from his settings of Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience. I'd always been skeptical about the idea of the poet as bard, or even worse, a shaman. These are easy cloaks to put on and easy to abuse, altogether too self-aggrandizing, yet Ginsberg was wholly convincing, his audience rapt. It was one of the most moving experiences of my life. I felt blessed. And I went home glowing to tell Barbara about the experience. She immediately sensed something dangerous in my response. She'd once observed that it wouldn't have surprised her entirely if one day she found a note from me saying that I was off. Not off as in off with another woman or to a different flat, but really off. Not off somewhere, but to nowhere, to anywhere. But she knew, as I knew even better, that I was far too dutiful, too conventional, and finally too frightened to do more than contemplate such a thing. I had an inner lexicon of sad and attenuated fantasies of life on the road, which involved moving from one stereotype to another. Open-topped cars on endless roads to nowhere. Vast western landscapes with critters and varmints howling in the night. Bars with drunken and available women, lonely motels, all of the stale tropes of noir fiction. It was a byproduct of the genius of Allen Ginsberg that, in reanimating these cliches, he made me feel more alive. Allen and Holden had become guides, though eventually their voices merged with whatever was developing as my own. They engendered loyalty and that kind of naive identification where we find ourselves unconsciously mimicking not merely our friends' attitudes, but also their habits, their likes and dislikes, voices and postures. For a time, I could recognize an inner Holden and an inner Allen Ginsberg, but eventually they got assimilated, increasingly mixed up with the myriad other voices I was to make my own, to make myself. Charles Lamb, in a much quoted phrase, claimed that he loved to lose himself in other men's minds, and that is indeed what I did, though not in the sense that Lamb would have intended. He thinks there's something comfortable about the process, something seamlessly enhancing. But my assimilation of the Caulfield and Ginsberg voices had something spurious about it. I didn't simply learn from them. I appropriated a whole series of attitudes and beliefs which were neither warranted nor engendered by my own experience. I despised phonies. I wanted to be lawless and to embrace all. Perhaps, though, that's the point, and what poor, frustrated Miss Wyeth was trying to teach us, that literature offers us foreign voices and enables, even urges us, to assimilate them. How we do that, of course, is up to us. You have to be careful whose company you keep and how. And therein lies the paradox. We cannot form our views of the world without exposure to other men's minds, yet in doing so, we risk something secondhand, inauthentic. Literature becomes both our experience and our substitute for experience. Is this why we sense in people who are steeped in literature a kind of intractable pomposity, as if they were swollen by voices not legitimately their own? As Charles Lamb was fond of remarking, they say, remarking it themselves, Charles Lamb, c'est moi. I cite, therefore I am. There's something compellingly ridiculous about the process. Even in its most distinguished examples, compulsive quoting always suggests something secondhand to me. Take Joan Didion's moving account of her response to the sudden death of her adored husband, John Gregory Dunn, in The Year of Magical Thinking. The text is littered with references to those writers Didion most admires and who may be able to offer insight or consolation. And reading her, I was irritated by this. Can't she grieve even without this plethora of literary reference? But there is nothing secondhand about the process, not to Joan Didion. These voices, these authorities, these friends are part of what and who she is. What is this chamber of citations, but the self? Whatever self I was beginning to form in high school sought eagerly, if not for a genuine escape, at least for some radical way of marking my difference and my disaffection. It would have to be subtle, this protest. No failing, no dropping out, no confrontations beyond the normal wisecracking, no locks flowing over the collar. At last, I found an ideal gesture. Every day during my final year at school, I would wear a sports jacket and a tie. Unlike the other boys in their chinos, checked shirts, and V-neck sweaters, I would set myself apart, formal and superior, and never indicate why I was doing so. And it wasn't easy. I only had the one green and gold threaded jacket, a couple of white button-down cotton shirts, and three thin ties, each with bright horizontal stripes. But I persevered. My fellow students were puzzled, but my teachers thought I looked nice. They didn't realize that I was dressing ironically. But Allen Ginsberg would have. I like to think he would have been proud of me.